Good morning, everyone. For some of us, we've been on this coming and going session for 2 weeks now. And of course, for some of us, just maybe today. But I'm finding, for me, at this point, my thoughts have gotten quite scattered and difficult to pin down. And this reminds me that I'm quite convinced that we can't actually personally own or hold on to this Dharma teaching. I'm quite conscious of the fact that to some extent I'm sort of at its mercy. My name is on the schedule to deliver a talk this morning, so it doesn't actually matter whether my mind is clear or cloudy. My practice this morning is to show up and sit on this cushion and open my mouth and hope that when I open my mouth, some Dharma appears and speaks. And I'm not so sure. In this section that I have been sitting with from Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we've been talking about here for 2 weeks, the last section of the second part of this book. He uses this lovely image of a river in Yosemite National Park and the huge waterfalls, right? And how impressed he was watching the water tumbling down from the top of the cliff and falling such a long distance. And he said it was quite surprising to him how slowly the water seemed to be moving as it came down the waterfall, because it's traveling such a great distance. And he imagined that as the water came tumbling off the cliff, it was broken up into individual droplets by smashing into rocks and the wind. And he imagined these droplets as being much like us, human beings. And each droplet separate, having its own individual experience of this great fall. And then at the bottom of the waterfall, the droplets disappear and rejoin this this great river. No problem. What fun to be a droplet, to live, to leap from the cliff and come tumbling down and land back in this river. And yet our experience as individual human droplets is often not so much of fun. We're so concerned about what's going to happen when we reach the bottom of this great waterfall. And this is fine, I think. This is part of what it means to be human. This vivid human life of ours, of being born and dying. No other way to live. This life not being possible without being separated into droplets. And this is how the great river lives, appears in the form of droplets. So, a bit later on in this section, I'll read you a paragraph near the end. He says, we say everything comes out of emptiness. One whole river, or one whole mind, is emptiness. When we reach this understanding, we find the true meaning of our life. When we reach this understanding, we can see the beauty of human life. So this first sentence here that I read, we say, everything comes out of emptiness. And as Diane, Dharma holder Diane Fitzgerald said about the first sentence that she quoted from this book, she said, so I'm not so much in love with this first sentence. Everything comes out of emptiness. But it gets better. He continues on and says, one whole river or one whole mind is emptiness. So this is perhaps what he means here by emptiness. This wholeness, this great river, the vast ocean, perhaps. And when we reach this understanding, we find the true meaning of our life. We can see the beauty of human life. So, the droplets falling from the cliff are expressing the life of the great river through being born and disappearing. So, throughout this book, Suzuki keeps using this term, big mind, which I think can be a bit problematic, because it immediately makes me think of a special state of mind or some sort of cosmic mind state that that I need to attain. But I've really been trying to work my way into what he might be talking about here with this big mind. And I think there's probably a number of different ways that this term validly can be interpreted. But I'm going to suggest for the purposes of this talk that we might be talking about the mind of Zazen. And I thought I would turn to Reb Anderson here, who was a one of Suzuki's primary students, and eventually was one of the people who helped put the San Francisco Zen Center back together with all the problems with Baker Roshi, Suzuki's heir. And So as I've been sitting in my zazen, I have been sitting with my body and mind together. I've really noticed as I've been practicing on this coming and going sesshin, the physicality of my practice in a somewhat different way. How important it is to embody this practice of zazen, this sitting upright. The title of Reb Anderson's book about the precepts, being upright in the middle of our experience, such an important thing. And so how do we find this big mind in the middle of our zazen? And the way that I've been practicing with this is rather than seeing this big mind as a particular thing, a particular sort of mind, more as an intention and an awareness that the mind of zazen is all-inclusive. Reb Anderson says in this piece that we read this morning, this guidance in Shikantaza, he says that zazen does not prefer success over failure or enlightenment over delusion. And I think, wow, so this is really foreign to my experience, right? Because I am totally in favor of success, and I am not too wild about failure. And some of the things that show up in my mind when I'm doing zazen are quite painful, and I dislike them intensely. And other things, you know, at other moments, it can be quite beautiful. And I love those moments. But this attachment to part of my experience and rejection of others, I think is exactly the thing that I am attempting to see through in my zazen practice. My practice is not to meddle with anything, as he says in this piece. He says, there is not the slightest meddling. It is physical and mental, non-interfering. So what if this practice of big mind is this mind of zazen that is all-inclusive? Whatever shows up, can I hold this as one manifestation of this universal big mind showing up as my tight little constricted small mind of greed and anger as the expression in this moment of this universal big mind? And I think for me this is the entry point. In the beginning of this piece, Reb says, Zazen is the source of all the teachings and practices of the Buddha way. All enlightenment practices emanate from and return to Zazen. This inclusive mind, and I'm really practicing with the idea that I don't have to feel any particular way about what shows up in my mind. That when I have a preference, the preference itself is included. Sometimes I am internally shaking my fist at my experience of the moment. And I do nothing to try to change that. I try to allow myself to feel exactly however it is that I feel in this moment, this acceptance of being this big mind that is willing to allow whatever shows up to be here, just as gently as I can, not interfering, not meddling. And I find this to be quite a relief in some moments, that if I can actually be with my difficult small self, there's a appreciation for even the difficulties. And this sense of this is how the great river lives through all these droplets tumbling off the cliff. And, how wonderful. This is how the universe plays. So wonderful and so difficult. Both are true and cannot be separated. Thank you. So we'll have our opportunity for a Dharma dialogue is our way on this retreat. Opportunity to ask questions or make comments. Christine?
Thank you so much for your talk, Steve. I resonate with that very much. And I take such heart from the passage in the book that talks about the good horse and the bad horse, because I've spent my life in almost everything trying to be a good horse, falling back over and over to be in the quote-unquote bad horse and needing to get whipped to the marrow. And I have a new appreciation after this time that I've spent here in this coming and going for the great gratitude of sitting in disagreeable very disagreeable circumstances, where when I first came here, I was watching myself, like at the end of a whip, and little me being whipped back and forth by my mind states and my emotions, and just the great grace and power of this practice, this community, the Dharma, and the gift of that. And so I'm so grateful
to know in leaving that that is, I don't have to be derailed by the disagreeable any more than when I am in my practice. And I just wanted to end with a question. Emptiness seems so spacious to me, and I'm not sure if that's correct, but I know Melissa often says that emptiness perhaps isn't the best translation, and the river, and I don't know, but is emptiness, I don't know. Is it spacious? I mean, it is spacious. What is the other translation that you say for emptiness?
So here I was pointing to the metaphor of this whole river or whole ocean, this all-inclusiveness. So the whole universe is not other than this emptiness that we're talking about, which is actually the problem I had with the first sentence about everything coming out of emptiness makes it sound like there are two things, right? The stuff and the empty, and that is not actually my understanding of this emptiness, right? The Heart Sutra says that, you know, form is exactly emptiness, and emptiness is exactly form. That these are two different understandings of this one thing. So to think that things come out of this emptiness that is somewhere else doesn't hit me as being quite right. Dogen goes on to say that form is exactly form, and emptiness is exactly emptiness, right? Because this thing that the Heart Sutra says of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, is a little dualistic, right? Because we're giving it two different names and saying and making them equal and saying, well, so, you know, there's this emptiness thing and it's the same as this form thing, and so he, I think, there is trying to go even a step beyond that and say, you know, form is exactly form. There really is this form thing, right? And emptiness is emptiness, and there's actually only one thing. Right, there's just this form and emptiness. That form is how emptiness expresses itself. How this whole river expresses itself.
And the word that I like to use instead of emptiness, because emptiness does imply nothing, a kind of void. Right, those are other words that are sometimes used. So the word in Sanskrit is shunyata, and the sense of that is more thusness. Which really is a better way of describing it, and very much in line with what Steve was just saying, right? So thusness. Sometimes it's very spacious. Sometimes it's very concrete, but it's that river.
And maybe it's wholeness. So the particular out of the whole. Something emerges, so we can enter into this wholeness. We can enter into this undifferentiated experience of, maybe shimmering, maybe spacious, all kinds of. And I loved what you said. Is emptiness? Is it? I don't know. I thought, oh, well, there's a lovely, lovely definition.
And the answer to that is yes.
Indeed.
And also no, because if we right, get concretizing it.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
So, talking about the waterfall and the droplets, and let me go back to, I really appreciate the starting out on, I don't know what will happen when I open my mouth. Mm-hmm. My mind is maybe not prepared to speak. So what I seem to notice about this practice is spending time in silence and practicing in silence. there might be more spaciousness between the droplets of water, whether it's words or parts of ourselves or thinking. And something about being okay with that and not knowing what words come next or what you think about things, or just allowing yourself to be in that river waiting for droplets to come off the cliff. If that makes any sense out of the outside of it.
Yeah. So there certainly is this sense of spaciousness, right, that can arise. And that, what a wonderful thing, right? This making room for this inclusion. It's actually okay how it is, right? So that's kind of how it comes up for me. The stuff that I don't want, you know, in some way, it's actually okay that it's showing up the way that it is. And there's this, you know, this space, this room to include all of the variety of experience, and how wonderful. And the only danger is that we attach to this feeling of spaciousness, right, which is not actually the thing that we're going for, right? We're looking for the all-inclusiveness, right, that I accept however it appears, and that, you know, in doing that, there maybe is some spaciousness that arises, but the goal is not to produce a feeling of spaciousness, of course, right, which sometimes we get. You know, we think, I need to have this spacious feeling, right? And it's not quite. It's how lovely that it arises that way, but to take that as the goal actually prevents us from reaching. I mean, it's you know, if I attach to spaciousness, it makes me unable to be present to the constriction, and this is actually my practice, is being present to the constriction. And if I can do that, then, you know, it may open up for me, or it may not, but sometimes it opens up, you know, and I go, ooh.
I think it feels very impersonal. It doesn't feel like it's my spaciousness.
Right, yeah.
It's spaciousness, right, that comes sort of instead of...
Right, yeah. And I think that's why he calls it big mind, right? It's bigger than we are, right? It's the whole universe is this spaciousness. And sometimes we can touch it. You know, it doesn't belong to us, but it includes us. And sometimes we can actually see, oh, yeah, I'm part of this great spaciousness. Saw Jenny's hand over here. Yeah.
I first heard that waterfall image in the Wild Parrots of Telegraph Hill documentary set in San Francisco, and I think he was talking about either this or Gary Snyder, but it really, that image really struck me, and I kind of visualized this painting like with the waterfall with babies at the top and old people at the bottom, and a droplet and cows and salamanders.
All pouring off the cliff.
Yay! And then let's go again.
Before I ever got into this meditation stuff. I think it was about a year ago, the last week of the coming and going, and I found Boundless Way and just confirmation again that I'm in the right place.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you, Jenny. And how great to have you here. Yeah. On the last coming and going, Sashina, I was sitting next to Jenny for quite a lot of the time, and it was so wonderful to see you start out unsure about this whole Mahayana Zen thing, right, coming from a different tradition, and then I could see yourself kind of living into it and how that's really blossoming this year. So, yeah, thank you, Jenny.
It's a great pointer to this weird thing that we already are Buddhas as we are, and things do develop, and you know, it's more like a settling into reality, and that's true for any of us who've been practicing, been on the way for a while. Nothing's happening, and everything's happening.
from the Zen sense, I'm struggling with a particular aspect, which is understanding what's being said.
Raise your hand.
And the first part, I need to hear it. So, it's a request that the ebb and flow is treated more, perhaps, in the pragmatic domain.
So you'd like people to speak a little louder.
A louder, and yes, make the clarity
great.
The syllables.
Yeah.
Hope great. It's not asking too much.
No, thank you for coming forward and asking that, because, you know, our real experience is not always mystical and deep and about waterfalls and water droplets, but what was the word you said? Right, yeah. So we manifest as that, so thank you for speaking up.
Sometimes at other sessions we've used a signal, and I think it's, is it this? Do you remember?
Does anybody remember? It's four, you know, like we use it, Orioki.
A little more.
Oh, a little more, that's what it is, yeah. So a little more, right? You could just put your hand up, and hopefully we'll see you. Yeah. Right. And that's what that means.
A little more.
Yeah. And you can do that during the talk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not sure. We might not see you during the talk.
Or a pair.
Yeah.
In terms of the hearing.
It's good you're sitting there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this directness of asking is so important. And we have the signal. And it might not always happen. You know, people are... So just know that you're clearly hearing what you need to hear.
That I have to accept.
Yeah.
That it may hurt.
Yeah.
I know, me too, sometimes.
And I love, of course, it's the both and. So both to say, I can't hear, and then we hear what we hear.
There's another aspect to this too. I thought I was getting hard of hearing, so my doctor sent me to the audiologist, and it was a wonderful experience. She came out and said, "Hello, you must be Melissa." And I said, "Yeah, I can hear you." And then she did all the tests, and she said, "Actually, your hearing is perfect, but you're getting old, so your comprehension is getting slower." And I said, "What?" Comprehension is getting slower. And she said, "You're just going to have to compensate for it."
That's more than I wanted to know.
So that's it. What's the other signal is?
I just wanted to say, as somebody who has been following this session largely from the audio files, I also appreciate when people speak up, because the talks are wonderful, but the questions and answers after, you know, are at least as good. So it always kills me. I commute an hour each way to work, and often I'm listening to them on that. And when somebody doesn't speak up, I'm like, "Oh, well,
what did you say?"
The answer sounded great, but I don't know.
What was the question?
Yeah.
So that's all.
That's the same when you're transcribing them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
it is. Transcribe it's rough.
Yeah, some of the questions are quite difficult to hear on the recording.
What did you say?
Perfect, yes. Yeah.
I said some of the questions are quite difficult to hear on the recordings.
And I always like to tell this story, and I'm telling it carefully, because it might imply that what you just said is invalid, but really, we need to speak up. So that's the truth. And I always remember that D.T. Suzuki was not the same person, Shinryu Suzuki. He came over when? In the 30s, maybe? And taught Rinzai Zen instead of the Soto Zen. Lot about enlightenment, wrote amazing books, and would come and tour and give talks. And the story is that one day, and he was a little guy with a very soft voice, and one day he was giving a lecture in New York, And the wind, it was in the summer and before air conditioning, and the windows were open and there was a lot of traffic noise. And people in the back of the room couldn't hear him. And so finally somebody brave enough raised their hand and said, "I can't hear you." And he said, "That's okay." So that's the other side of it, right? Mm-hmm. We do hear what we need to hear, and you must ask for what you need. Both are true. So maybe that's a good place to stop.